College holds a mythic place in American culture. But there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, folks. We've got a great show lined up for you today. At 12:30, we're going to meet with Lewis Fitzmaurice, the St. Tammany Parish Assessor. He has put together a quadrennial report which highlights St. Tammany, how it differs from the surrounding parishes, where the tax base actually is, where these ad valorem taxes are coming from. I was going through it last night. Very well done. Would love to see every parish do something very similar. Maybe a lot of them do, and I'm just not aware of it. But the fact of the matter is that really valuable information, especially for you as taxpayers. I would suggest you go to his website, pull that report down. It really outlines everything that you need to know about ad valorem taxes in the parish of St. Tammany, where they're collected from, and what tax recipient bodies receive them. At the top of the 12 o'clock hour, we'll visit with Frank Smart. He's the professor of preventative cardiology. He's a chief of the section of cardiology at LSU Health. There's a recent study that was published in the Journal of the American Heart Association, which found that 10 and 18-year-olds who spent more time focused on devices, phones, televisions, computers, gaming, consoles, they're at higher risk for cardiometabolic diseases, including high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and insulin resistance. I know the kids and the gamers and everybody else are going to hate me for talking about this, but very interesting information here, something that every parent should be aware of, that moderation may be the best course of action for your young kids. We have our NOLA Coalition segment. It's going to be at 11:30 with Ryan Mattingly, the executive director of Louisiana Green Corps. These folks have been difference makers for a long, long time. This month, as you all know, marks the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And that event actually catalyzed Louisiana Green Corps' work. And we'll talk about where they're at relative to that. Andronika Morris joins us, Executive Director of Housing NOLA, multi-million-dollar shortfall in a city fund. No big surprises there. We just can't seem to get to a situation where the left hand knows what the right hand is doing. That's what it looks like to me. I may be wrong. We'll see what Andronika Morris has to say about this housing fund and the spending of ARPA dollars that were, in fact, dedicated for that purpose. Ronald Surpass is going to join us at 10:30. You've probably heard by now that President Donald Trump has deployed the National Guard to D.C. as well as federal law enforcement agents there to crack down on crime and homelessness in the city. Now, there are a lot of people talking about a lot of different things relative to this and saying that, you know, D.C. is the safest that it's been in 30 years. Okay. So what does that mean? So we're going to try and define and engage in a conversation with former Chief Surpass about what is high crime? What is it? We talk about it all the time, but how do you judge it? How do you quantify high crime? And then once we get through that, we're going to talk about whether or not short-term versus long-term strategies are what is actually needed here. Seems as though they have a lot of crime reported and a lot of juvenile crime that goes unresolved. Does that sound familiar? It's some of the same issues that we have going on here in the city, where in large measure, a lot of what we're doing relative to our juvenile offenders is a nothing burger. We're not dealing with it. And when we have alternative to incarceration programs, we're not following up. We're not making sure that they're hitting all of the mileposts that they need to hit in order to come out from under the jurisdiction of the court. We've seen that these stories repeated over and over and over again. We've seen incredibly high recidivism rates. Is this just the policies of what's going on? Now, Congress has a lot of authority in the District of Columbia. There are a lot of policies coming out of the D.C. Council that, you know, are kind of head scratchers. We're kind of avoiding dealing with juvenile crime. In fact, most of the folks in mainstream media, they're not even talking about it. They're not even reporting the flavor of what is actually going on there, because it got so defensive because we have a Democrat mayor and a Republican president who's very aggressive and very proactive and seems to be a man of action. I don't always agree with what he's going to do. But the fact of the matter is that if we can't be safe in the nation's capital that has access to more funds than other cities traditionally and historically, because they're in the nation's capital. But what we have seen is a hodgepodge of policies coming out of there, a misuse, improper spending of dollars. We've elected people that are dope fiends, drug addicts, to serve as mayor. We have had more internal theft going on there. In fact, just recently, they fired a police commander for fudging the numbers to try and make it look like it's not nearly as bad as it once was. We've had this complete total breakdown in the governance of this issue. We had this particular mayor, Muriel Bowser, who for years during COVID was hell-bent on walking to the beat of a different drum, contrary to the safety and security of her families, being incredibly onerous as it relates to some gatherings, but no big deal to put, you know, 25,000 people in the street to protest something. COVID's not going to spread there. It's a COVID-free zone, kind of like a sanctuary city. Wasn't going to be a problem at all. And we wonder why we find ourselves in the predicament that we find ourselves. Instead of just governing, right? Just governing. Not getting all wrapped up in the social warfare, ideological warfare, being in the nation's capital. And what ultimately happened? The place became Ghost Town USA. The D.C. economy ended up in shambles. And any time that you have distress, opportunities for jobs, and other things of that nature, what is the byproduct of that? Typically more crime. Now, I'm not one to believe that those are the only contributors as it relates to crime, and that when you do aggressive policing, that you're going to actually make matters worse. A lot of these things go hand in glove with one another. The liberal bent wants to try and make you believe that access to health care, access to jobs, access to opportunities are the panacea as it relates to crime, violent crime in an area. Well, D.C.'s had that in the past. What was the excuse then? D.C. has always been one of the most violent crime cities in America. D.C.'s always had a relaxed attitude about enforcement. It's been an incredibly liberal-led city that has been very progressive for a long time, making excuses for crime as opposed to holding people accountable. And they become the victim of just kind of the blank check mentality, especially if there's a Democratic leader in the White House. They get what they want, when they want, how they want, and they get used to that. And when things change, it's hard to get off of that financial tit. And they don't really actually know what to do at that point in time because they're actually not governing. It's easy to do things when you have unlimited funds going your way, little resistance in front of you, and you're able to embark on whatever journey you want to embark on without having to really figure out what the financial morass might be as a result of decisions that you are having to make. Because if you get into a pickle, you call Big Daddy in the White House and you get another check. You get another grant. You get access to another program. They became the social laboratory, and they received the funding to do so about all kinds of different programs that were going to be tried there. And, you know, in the end, when we look back historically, they've still had an issue. So I don't know that this is going to be the right move. I have my doubts about it, but I certainly can understand that there should be a desire in this country that the nation's capital be one of the safest cities in America. That's where we invite other political leaders from around the country. Most people take a lot of pride in their nation's capital to show it off. This is what we're about. You've heard me say this a million times. Human nature is the first impression is the lasting impression. The impression of this country when you visit D.C. is not very good. It hadn't been good for years. It's not a city that you can just walk around without looking over your shoulder all the time. And what's interesting is if they did probably a private poll of mainstream media folks, which you will find a large majority of them have been victims of crime in D.C. If you did a private poll of interns, both Republicans, Democrats, and independents, what you will find is that a large proportion of them have been victims of crime in D.C. If you talk to restaurateurs that are there, what you will find is that historically they've had trouble being able to staff these restaurants, incredible restaurants, some of the finest restaurants in the country, with the appropriate staff in D.C. for a whole host of reasons. And they've had kind of an artificial economy, artificial to the extent they're very much like New Orleans, where they're wedded to the tourism industry, but they have a business community spend there during the day and at night that has been a lot easier in many respects for folks to achieve some level of success, other than the fact that taxes are high and property values are higher as well. So the entry cost is a little steep. But there are a lot of people used to be at one point in time walking the streets of D.C., not any longer. And now D.C. is going to cry because there's a movement to right-size federal government. Because you see, the more people that the federal government employs, the better D.C. does on a whole bunch of different fronts. Now they're having to look internally as to alternatively how they're going to be able to survive. Now more than ever, there's a need and a desire to have someone who can actually govern and can pull this city through the challenges that it faces. And the first challenge, not unlike all other cities, we know this better than most, is to address crime and safety. Because if you don't address crime and safety, you're not going anywhere fast. You don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure that out. Now, there are a lot of restrictions, and we'll talk about that with Ronald Surpass when he joins us in just a few minutes, about this move for the Guard and federal law enforcement authorities going into D.C. proper. But we know all too well the downstream implications of not being serious about making sure that you have an impact on juvenile crime. We know all too well when you have progressive judges, lenient judges, that want to make excuses for juvenile offenders that commit violent crime. We know all too well of the impact generationally that some of these players have in this city. Because we've coddled and we babysat these offenders for so many years. It's amazing how some of these judges actually view their role. They believe a success is being able to keep a kid out of trouble during their juvenile years. Not whether there's still the high propensity for that juvenile to get in trouble, but they view themselves as getting them out of trouble by being lenient when they do get caught, where they're not spending a lot of time, they're not developing a significant criminal history, so to speak. Not that much of that is going to matter anyway, because it's kept a secret, right? They view that as a success. In my view, a success would be if we do a 3-year look back 3 years after reaching majority. Where do we find these individuals that have gone through these programs that have been implemented by juvenile courts? Did they make a meaningful impact on that young adult? Be interesting to see where we find these offenders 3 years after reaching the age of majority. I suggested that for probably 20 years. No one wants to do it. Wonder why? I suspect it's because they already know what the outcome is going to reveal. It will be pretty but ugly. And I can't imagine that it's going to be too terribly different in any other city across the country. But if we really want to get serious about dealing with juvenile crime, that is how we should view, in my humble opinion, the success or failure of programs that we deploy and the millions upon millions of dollars that we're spending in doing so. The proverbial ROI. Are we getting the return on our investment? Are we really moving kids? Are we helping with the development of a moral compass? These kids understand the concept of right from wrong. The real question is, do they give a damn? A lot don't. But unless and until we get serious about this, we're going to be right back in the situation that D.C. finds itself right now. The amount of D.C. violent crime that's perpetrated by juveniles is horrendous. Horrendous. So we'll be joined by Ronald Surpass when we come back after the break, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. He's a former NOPD chief. He served as the head of the Washington State Police and also the chief of the Nashville Police Department. So he has seen juvenile court systems, juvenile justice systems in three different states. And I look forward to hearing from him as to his observations of the challenges there. And what do you do? What do you do if you have a leadership that's not really willing to come to the table, change the course of action, change its ideology, change the strategy in moving forward? How do you affect change. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Ronald Serpas, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, former chief of Nashville PD, and also the head of the Washington State Police. And as I said earlier, he's been exposed to juvenile justice systems and adult justice systems in three separate states. So he speaks with authority on, you know, a lot of what works, what doesn't work from the perspective of having visited three different states, and I appreciate that. Ronald, welcome to the show.
Hey, Newell. It's always good to be with you. How are you?
Good. Ronnie, I want to try and approach this this way, get to the question of the, you know, sending the feds into D.C. We have a lot of folks that are saying that D.C. is the safest that it's been in 30 years. And that very well may be true. But how do you define high crime? I mean, let's tackle that first, because if you look at President Trump's release, he says that in 2024, D.C. saw a homicide rate of 27.3 per 100,000 residents, the fourth highest homicide rate in the country, six times higher than New York City, higher than Atlanta, Chicago, and Compton. And if D.C. was a state, it would have the highest homicide rate of any state in the nation. In 2012, the homicide rate in D.C. was just 13.9 per 100,000 residents. Their population has been pretty stable. It's grown here recently by about 35,000 people. They have a population of around 702,250. So how do you define high crime? Where do you start?
Well, I think the first thing is there's none so blind as those who refuse to see. 27 homicides per 100,000 is going to drop to 24 if they have a better year this year versus 13 just a decade ago. So you got to see what you got to see. Secondly, you and I've talked about this before. The government measures crime data. Secondly, we know that the government data is half wrong just because people don't call. Thirdly, a D.C. police commander was suspended in May for fudging the crime numbers. And fourth, crime is a perception that people feel from what they hear from their friends, families, and neighbors, more so true to them than anything else we just said. So, you know, when you and I were in this business, you half a century, me only 45 parts of a century, I think we both knew intuitively that a crowd of people don't really give a damn about your crime numbers. They care that they don't feel safe, that their neighbor said they was robbed, their family member says they lost their car. So that's the quagmire that I think politicians are stuck in because they somehow or another believe, many, not all, that these crime numbers are mythical and they're magical and they can make everything all better. They don't. People feel crime. The government reports numbers. People feel crime.
And then when you look at, I've never been one to really believe that the homicide rate was really reflective of the overall crime of violence rate in a community or other types of crimes, because a lot of those murders, as we well know, are relational. The victim and the perpetrator know one another. There's a conflict that brings them to that confrontation, which is different than a lot of other crimes, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. And from a research point of view, when we know everything that we can know about a murder or a sexual assault, generally about eight times out of ten, there was some sort of a knowledge between the people of one another. Robberies, on the other hand, be they with a weapon, which is an armed robbery, or with a fist, which is a simple robbery, those are almost 90% somebody you don't know. When someone breaks into your car, right? Oh, Lou, this is a good point. You and I had to deal with this a lot. We count crimes the way the FBI said to crown them, going all the way back to the 1930s. They determined in this crime capture mechanism that we still use today that a property crime is a burglary. Well, there ain't nothing more personal to anybody on earth than somebody breaking into their house. So, again, the crime data misleads people to think that somehow or another the government thinks burglary is less important than getting beat up. It's more important because you're the victim. So, as you said, crimes of murder, crimes of sexual assault, they almost always know one another in some way. That doesn't make it better. It just means that's what we know. But if you're walking down the street and somebody punches you in the back of the head, a group of juveniles, and takes your wallet, yeah, that's a serious violent crime to you.
Absolutely. And, you know, so it's kind of interesting because there's a split in the mainstream media as to is this necessary? Is it as bad as what the president is saying, you know, that crime is on the decrease there? That's why I wanted to start with, well, what is high crime? I mean, you know, and I think you laid it out perfectly as to what it really is and the feeling that people have in their community, the place that they call home. So let's talk about
Absolutely. Going
in now. So we go in, and this is where I have some of my bigger problems with this, is that, you know, this short-term versus long-term strategy. And what is it that we can actually do? Because without congressional approval, it looks like the president has the authority to kind of do things in about 30-day snippets there, with the exception of federal law enforcement and tasking them to do certain things inside of the district. Your thoughts?
I think that might speak to something I'm not as expert as you, and that would be this. If the president and the statutes, and I'm sure you've already covered this with the audience, he's using a particular statute that's unique to the D.C. government that is part of the relationship historically between the federal government and the District of Columbia. So that's a statute that has nothing to do with the Insurrection Act. But I think your point about 30 days is really crucially important, because if they were to make a big difference in 30 days, then maybe that's all they would kind of get done to put pressure on the local government to perform differently. I don't know. I'm like you, I have some questions in my mind how much you could really get done in 30 days. But I also know this. If you were living in Avondale in the 80s and 90s, or you were living in the Ninth Ward in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, 20s, and anybody said they were going to do anything to try to help you self safer, they felt good about it.
Oh, they would absolutely support it. For the most part. I mean, it's interesting to hear the leadership of D.C. and their reaction. I mean, this is like a threat to democracy. This is all over. I got to imagine if you interviewed
threat to democracy is the councilman who got reelected after taking bribes that he's going on trial for. I mean, that's when it starts to become very political and kind of silly. Now, I can't disclose everything because I am a professional consultant. I happen to know a lot about that place in very recent times. And like many large departments, they're struggling with things that everybody does. Recruitment, retention, equipment, very strict labor rules about employment and such. But that doesn't mean they can't learn and they can't do better things. Chuck Ramsey, a dear friend of mine and yours, went there with all those same questions and all those same quarrels, and he made a huge difference. The question is, who's going to make a huge difference? If the president thinks he can make a huge difference in 30 days, maybe it'll just be enough to spark them thinking differently from where they are today.
Yeah, you know,
I don't want to tell you? I always get the biggest kick out of when people say, we should feel good that crime went down this year. That's like saying the Saints should feel good because instead of losing 9, they only lost 8. It's a political way of answering a question that the media gobbles up as if it's some words from the text of the Bible. But the people in the community go, we still lost half the time. What do you mean it's better? It's not better.
And that's what, you know, we try to politicize this thing so much. And you know, the reality is that this is the nation's capital. And I think you would agree with me. They got more attention from a financial perspective, programmatically, almost a blank check in many respects. They certainly got the lion's share of every granting program that ever existed, at least while I was in law enforcement. Everybody envied what they and the New York Police Department got in that respect. We got, you know, crumbs, and they got the whole enchilada. And, you know, so they have no excuses there. Now, how they ultimately ended up spending the money, I don't know, but I remember hearing a lot of stories that were not very favorable.
Well, they have a unique circumstance that cuts both ways for them. One, if there's a First Amendment speech protest, they have to police it, and they do a lot of that. I mean, I'll give them all credit. Mm-hmm. I've seen the data. They do a lot of that. But the other thing that cuts in their favor that the D.C. political leadership probably doesn't want to talk about is that every alphabet federal agency that's headquartered in D.C. has some sort of a uniform function. The FBI has a uniform function. The Secret Service has a uniform function. All those uniformed members of the federal government protecting their buildings looks the same to a citizen as a D.C. police officer. So it looks like there's a lot of cops there. Where it gets to become quite sticky is when you get outside of the main D.C., you know, cube, and you get out into some of those neighborhoods, Anacostia and some of those other ones, and there are some serious violent crimes that have been going on since the 1990s. You may remember, now that I'm thinking about it, my dear friend, your dear friend, and my personal mentor, Richard Pennington, he was hired here by Mark Morial, and one of the key reasons he hired him is because he was coming from a very dangerous city to help make our dangerous city better. Remember? So
yep,
D.C. has always had this issue. And I think Richard did a tremendous job for us, and he was a great friend for us, but he got hired because he came from a place that had a worse crime problem than we did. Imagine that. That was in 1994.
So, Ronnie, when we got to get to a break, when we come back, I want to think in the context going back to the short-term versus long-term strategy and that friction point relative to policing in D.C. We'll be right back. We're visiting with Ronald Surpass, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola and former NOPD chief. Stay with us, folks.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Vehicle theft in Washington, D.C. is more than three times the national average, ranking it amongst the most dangerous cities in the world. Carjackings increased 547% between 2018 and 2023. And in 2024, there were triple the number of carjackings compared to 2018. These are the type of crimes that you were talking about, Chief, earlier, that really gets people on edge, right? They're looking over their shoulder. They're feeling very uncomfortable. They don't like leaving their home.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the federal government has limitations on juvenile crime, obviously, but they don't have a limitation on some of those types of crimes. As we both know, there are federal statutes that allow some prosecution at the federal level for different types of robberies. I would expect that in this short period of time, they may take some actions in that regard and then put political pressure. And, you know, it's been in our career 50 years ago when you started, Linda Ronstadt, "You're No Good" was the number one song. Recommend you put that on your show. But, you know, We've seen the iteration of parents should be responsible. It's really not parents' fault. Parents should be responsible. It's not parents' fault. Two quick comments on that. For every one child that's making bad decisions in a city like New Orleans or D.C., there's hundreds who don't. We need to celebrate those families for taking care of their children. And for the one child that tells their parent at 2 o'clock in the morning, "I'm going out for the night," then obviously they are not getting the job done. But a sage advice was given to me a long time ago by a politician. If you're waiting for the government to raise your children, nothing good comes from that.
That is no doubt, no doubt at all. Interesting, you know, there's a lot of similarities of the challenges that we've had here in the city as it relates to the challenges of what they're having in D.C. Relative to juvenile justice. At some point, something's got to give, right? I mean, you can't just keep perpetuating and pollinating criminal behavior and think it's going to ultimately go away.
Well, what's truly sad, and you and I have a bias, and I want to be honest with the audience, I can't unsee the things I've seen as a police officer. You can't unsee the things you've seen. And we recognize that bias, but we also recognize that there are families, not unlike these great mafia stories that we've read about since the 30s, who focus on crime. That's their livelihood, and there are some people in the world who recoil when you say that as if somehow or another they're the victims of society and it's not their fault. No. You and I have seen crime families, not just the familial ones, but the actual crime families that are friends or neighbors or even cousins. And they are deadly serious about their business, and we have to be just as serious about policing them. That hasn't changed over the last 45 years for me or 50 years for you.
No, not at all. So when we talk about short-term versus long-term strategy, obviously what's going on here is it's a short-term pump in some assets, try to do some things. And I think you're right. It's an attempt to get people to recognize, look at themselves in the mirror critically and say, hey, maybe we need to be more aggressive. Maybe we need to be more proactive. Maybe we need to focus on some things that we haven't focused on.
Well, I'll say this to you, Newell, and I'm not going to want to get political, but I do remember that the border couldn't be controlled for 4 years. And right. The president now said, we just needed a new president, and look what happened. Maybe that's the message they're trying to send to these cities, is that maybe you just need a new way of being mayor or a new way of being chief. Maybe we don't need new rules and new policies and new procedures. We do need a new theme song, You're No Good, Linda Ronstadt, 1974, number one pop song. But thank you for having me today.
I love you, my friend.
You're the best, Newell. You are the best.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you for taking time out today. I know you are busy. But I think you probably have been in the game longer than me.
Well, if you count when I ran from the police, maybe.
Have a great week.
All right. Thank you, brother.
We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Kind of wonder, what do you fear by having the assistance? It'd be a great question to ask these folks. All right, folks, when we come back after the top of the news break, we'll visit with Andronica Morris, Executive Director of Housing NOLA. We'll talk about the multi-million dollar shortfall in the city fund created 2 years ago to provide gap financing for affordable housing. How that happened, where we find ourselves, can it be corrected? We'll be right back. Stay with us.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.